was here last year, January 5th, and we talked about what does it mean, this word rest, and we explored the idea of being able to rest attention on a particular object in a way that brought us calm and well-being, just as being able to rest the body on the earth allows the physical body to rest. So we explored all these different objects of attention where we could rest, where we could find a ground where that the nervous system would rest, just be at ease. So shortly after that, I can't remember exactly how many days, I began an adventure that was diagnosed over the phone as a severe case of the flu, and may have been a severe case of the flu, may not have been. It's not known at this point. And at the end of 6 days of being bedridden, being on the couch during the day and in the bed at night, just really wiped out, I developed a lot of pain in the abdomen, and really quite extreme. And I had been told that that might be one of the things that would be a symptom of the flu, so I made no effort to check with my doctor or check with my friend who's a doctor or anything else. And I just sat with it as an experience, which turned out to be quite a grueling experience and also not very wise. And part of that was that I, part of what allowed that to happen is that I developed through all of these decades of practice the ability to stay with an experience. Well, so I became resigned that this is the experience. I could really settle into it without much objection. The problem with that is that sometimes you overlook that there's a message in that discomfort. And there was a major message here, and I failed to receive it in a timely manner. And then I finally made it 24 hours too late to the emergency room. And then through a series of circumstances, that was the night of the storm and all the big storm, that all the power went out in the hospital and all this. And anyway, I was another 24 hours before being attended to, and so I ended up with what had been somewhere along the line, the appendix was rupturing, but by the time they got in there, there was no appendix. It was all gone, and there was gangrene and so forth. And the surgeon told me after the surgery that had I been another 2 or 3 hours delay in getting to the hospital, I would have died. And I took all of this as great information, and I was certainly pleased that I had gotten to the hospital when I did, but also wanted to learn from my experience, just as we all need to learn from all of our experiences around whatever challenge it is that we face. And the skill sets that we learn in our spiritual exploration or our internal exploration, if you don't like that word spiritual, or our mindfulness, if you like that word, or our vipassana, if you like that word. Vipassana, those of you who are new, means looking through, seeing. It's, and vipassana is like a word for insight, like you're seeing through the surface level and you have an aha moment, like, ah, that's how it really is. And so way you would describe your practice, or whether you're just a sampler here tonight and not really committed yet to practice, in this tradition, this Theravada tradition, there is great emphasis placed on understanding the nature of conditional reality. And one of the reasons for that is because so much of conditioned reality, based on circumstances, that's what conditioned means, that there's so many things about it that are quite difficult. Certainly the unpleasant, we're going to sort of focus on those more tonight, the unpleasant, or it's easy to see why, if we can have a wiser relationship with that which is unpleasant in our life, it's a benefit to us. It's pretty clear. Yes, you might not say, oh, I don't believe this will be a benefit, but surely you would want something that would be a benefit of you to you in terms of dealing with the difficult, dealing with what's challenging. And amazingly, even when things are going really well, these same examinations, these same directing attention to have a deeper understanding of something also has a benefit in relation to that which is pleasant in life. And so in that way, we're using our practice first to meet the life we have, and then to move beyond the conditional to what is referred to as the unconditioned. The unconditioned attracts a lot of people because they think it's going to be a special experience, or they're going to have special experiences along the way, and to some degree we do. And others are drawn because of the dukkha of life, and that dukkha meaning the unsatisfactoriness, the physical and emotional pain of life, the stress of life, the unreliability of anything to stay the way we want it for any length of time, and then the dukkha of that, even when it's a moment that's really just as we would want it, there's still a little existential problem of finding the there. We just can't really, it's just difficult, it's challenging to find the there. And so we then start to say, well, how do I relate to this subjective experience I have of conditions? And there's ever-flowing, ever-changing natures, that's called anicca, the ever-flowing change of experience. One moment is followed by another, which we can't stop those moments from flowing. We can make ourselves unconscious to those flowing moments. We can distract ourselves from an awareness of them. But one moment follows another, like a stream of from the winter rains flowing down, up in the parklands, just this rushing stream. So is our momentary experience, one moment flowing by the next. And they're conditioned in small ways and large ways. So the larger ways can be something like my discomfort that I had around this appendix. That was ongoing for, I spent 14 hours with that pain as my object of meditation. And I say that literally, not some sort of metaphoric way. It was my object. I was trained to have 4 decades of training to be able to stay with any object as an object of meditation. So I did. And so we can stay with an object, or we can move away from an object, and so forth. Now, when I talk about challenges, I do mean physical health and our physical limitations that we have in our abilities, lack of vitality, challenge of emotional health, of capacity, of, again, of vitality of some kind. We can have challenges of security issues, whether we are feeling physically safe, whether we feel emotionally safe, whether we have a financial safety, whether or not we feel safe within our community, with the values reflected in our community or our values, or in the larger culture, or in the legal system that is established where we don't feel safe. And then we can also feel really challenged by a sense of responsibility for ourselves, or feel responsible for others, and that is really challenging, particularly if some of these other conditions are present too. We feel responsible for others, but we have a financial challenge, we have a health challenge, we can have an emotional challenge, we can have all of these things going on at once. This coming Saturday or Sunday, I can't remember which day it is.
Saturday,
I'm going to be doing the, 18th, 19th to 20th annual Care Providers Day. And it's a chance for Spirit Rock to thank those people in our community that are care providers. And I'm quite honored to get to do that, to be the one who thanks the care providers. But often the care provider that is helping someone with challenges has all these challenges of their own simultaneous that they're helping others. And it's just a very, very tough road, row to hoe. So there can be also challenges of relatedness in relationship, or just a general relatedness. We can feel isolated. We can feel alone. We can feel as though our experiences are not that of other people. There can be psychological challenges. There can be stress, anxiety, depression, a lack of relatedness, old traumas, a loss of a sense of confidence, of self-worth, and on and on and on. All of these different kinds of challenges. And there can also be a kind of general malaise, a sense of lack of joy, a sense of dissatisfaction, of some sort of unknown distraction that we walk around with all the time. Nothing that is really calling you, so you don't really feel, what I call an eroticism towards life, a movement towards life. And as you, those of you who've been here very much, you know that I teach that life is movement, and without movement there is no life. And it's our relationship to the movement that we are developing, and so that we develop a kind of stillness and a kind of awareness and all in relation to movement. But it's not taking away movement. We're not wanting to take away movement, but a lot of these challenges can lead us to kind of collapse in relation to life. And so there's a kind of there was a teacher, Buddhadasa Bhikkhu, that got very interested in a couple of the suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses of the Buddha, in which there's this mention of this particular list of insights. And they're called the nine eyes. He referred to them as the nine eyes because the word ta or datta translates that way. So another way to understand them is that Buddhadasa is presenting these nine knowings as a deeper and deeper insight about the nature of our regular life, of conditioned life. So this is like, and it's not this clean and neat, but it's like the first thing we would do is we understand how we relate more and more skillfully, and we let loose of demand and all these nine levels of understanding of our conditioned life. And then we get to this kind of spiritual realm where we're having these great liberating insights that lead us to nibbana, lead us to total freedom. And again, as I said at the beginning, some people are drawn to this practice by the dukkha, by the suffering, by the unsatisfactoriness, and some are drawn by this great promise of full freedom. But the way I would suggest to that full freedom is to understand the dukkha more and more deeply. And this, in fact, is what the Buddha says in the Four Noble Truths. He starts with that there is dukkha, there is suffering, there is this unsatisfactoriness, there's physical and emotional pain, and all the challenges that I listed earlier. There is dukkha. And the second noble truth is that there is a cause for dukkha. It's this demand. This demand, we have demand for pleasant experience, sensory experience of various kinds, and demand for things to be, to become something they're not now, or demand that things not be the way they are now, that we don't want to be. We don't want to be at all. So like there was lots of times when I could see why I would not want to be during my experience of dealing with this pain. Did not go that way, but certainly felt it. So how do we move beyond getting caught in all of our wanting, all of our demands about conditions, so that we can then go to this larger and larger picture? And Buddhadasa suggests these insights that we have. And that was our practice. We had one insight after another. And I said during the guided meditation that insight is a felt experience. It starts out as an intellectual experience, but it becomes more and more a felt experience. So it can start out as, we can actually start out as you've heard something or you have this passing thought on your own about something, this is really the truth of things. And then like you go, I wonder about that, but then you don't really get interested, then you do, and you get this intellectual understanding, so you know the dictionary definition or the teacher definition of what something means, like the word dukkha, or and then so you think, okay, now I have this understanding of it, and you go, oh yeah, I know suffering in my life, and you think, oh, I've had the insight of it, but probably not. The insight is a much deeper experience than the actual, just the pain of emotional pain or physical pain. It's like getting the whole relationship. Like, why is it like it is? And we see the role of mind in causing us around our difficulty, and with one thing after another. So in this particular list of nine, Buddhadasa starts with seeing impermanence, seeing that things are always changing, that's an insight, that it's to be had as a felt experience. First, just an intellectual concept, and then an intellectual understanding, and then a lived understanding. Oh my God, it's really true. Every moment is replaced by another moment. It's just going right on all the time. It's going on so fast, in fact, that when we drop in at the insight level, we will often feel nausea or fear or disorientation because it's too much at first. So that's the first of these, and a maturing practice, that we really do feel like we have some sense of anicca. It's not that it doesn't deepen, but we really do feel like, oh my goodness, yes, I know that. I have a felt sense of it. It's registered in my nervous system. And then the second, and this path of maturing, is that of dukkha, of the unsatisfactoriness. That, yes, there's great moments in life, and there's moments that's not great, but that ever-changing nature sort of screws it all up. If it was great, it would really just stay totally great for a while, and then it was ungreat for a while, that would be better. But it's all turned around in all these different ways. And like, and the mind just struggles with that so much. And so this is the inside of dukkha, understanding dukkha, the eye, where you see clearly dukkha. And then the third, which is the third of the three characteristics, which is all the things that we think are me and mine, but that turn out not to be me or turn out not to be mine, that I, when I look closely, that what I think is myself isn't myself because I can't control it, and it's always changing, and it often changes in ways that I don't want. So this is not what I'm thinking is me is not me. It's just part of this passing experience. Many, many more things about that, of course. So these are the three characteristics that the Buddha describes as the nature of this reality. And it doesn't initially sound like good news, you know. Everything's always changing. There's got all this tension comes with it, all this unsatisfaction comes with it, and then there's not even a there at the end. I'm going through all of this, protecting something that I can't really find when I look for it. That's not such a great thing. But in fact, understanding this starts to bring us more spaciousness to our experience, because the moment is true. The moment is as the moment is. It is like this. And in a way that these next set of insights start to reveal. And the first of those is there is this, it's called Dharma Hitta, but this, the naturalness, the steadiness of nature, that there is, that nature is, that it's nature. Those of you who go on retreats, particularly if you're on monastic retreats, you often hear them saying this, it's nature. It's just nature. It's the way it is. And that that it's nature, that it's naturally arising, that it's not like some condemnation. The nature of this realm is the nature of this realm. So being born into this realm means we get the goodies of this realm and we get the difficult of this realm. It's nature. There's not something weird about it that we have difficulty. It's the nature of this. It's like this. You'd think that would be a pretty... we got plenty of data that says that, right? Everyone in this room is old enough to have plenty of experiences to look back and go, yeah, when I think about me and my experience, and then I think about everybody else and their experience, yeah, it's true enough that I'm willing to accept that this realm is of a certain way. But when we encounter the difficult, we get afraid, we get longing, we're demanding one thing or another, we really tend to forget the nature of the realm. And we can get lost in so many different ways. And therefore we reject our experience of the moment, and that makes the experience of the moment more difficult. One of the ways that I stayed with these 14 hours of this intense pain as my object is that I was not objecting to it. Now, I also thought it was because I had the flu and I had no choice. If I'd known I had choice, I would have done something about it wisely. But I thought, okay, this is the flu and I'm just supposed to live through this. Now, again, there were too much stoicism, too much being with things as they are, that's clouded my judgment in the moment of that. Really want to own that, because I don't want to be, I want to serve as an inspiring example to you, not to have you as an imitative example. One reason I was able to do that is I did not have an objection to what we call in Buddhism the second arrow. Something unfortunate happens to you and then you start objecting to it. You start feeling sorry for yourself or demanding it be otherwise, and so you create a mental suffering on top of the objective experience of the suffering. So there is a subjective added suffering which has not a an additive effect, but a multiplying effect. So 3 degrees of physical pain with 6 degrees of objecting to it is 18 units of suffering, as a rough example. It's not 9, it's 18. And the more intense, those numbers get really large. And so not doing that, is not creating that mental objection, is the path through the Eightfold Path of the Four Noble Truths. So this we realize that, okay, there's nature. This is the nature of this realm. In my working with people in change and transition, oftentimes when they've come over a transition that's difficult, they have forgotten that the kind of difficulty they're having is natural in this realm. It's natural. It's natural. This is the way it happens to human beings in this realm. There's a wide array of who gets which, you know, experiences, but all these experiences are of this realm. It's impersonal. It's the nature of this realm. And then the next insight that comes is this really understanding that everything is based on conditions. That's a hard one to get. It wouldn't seem as though it should be that hard, but really everything's conditioning every moment. And this moment's so conditioned. Like right here, right now, you're either physically comfortable or you're not physically comfortable. You're either interested in this or not interested in this. And there's this whole slew of conditions that have come together that are defining your experience of this moment. The more mindfulness you have, the more you've worked, the less you are defined by those conditions. The less mindfulness, the more fully you are defined by the conditions. It's impersonal. It goes back to the previous insight. It's the nature of this realm. The nature of this realm is that we are defined to a large degree. We're certainly characterized by conditions, and without insight, this moment of our experience is simply defined by them. In the meditation, I was referring to noticing pleasant and unpleasant as to whether or not it's what pulled you away. It's just the nature of this. It's a conditioned-based realm. It's just conditioned-based. You can argue that all realms would have to be conditioned-based, but we don't have to get into that since we're not looking at all realms. We're looking at this realms of existence, and maybe you don't believe there are any other realms of existence, or maybe you do, but you would think they would have to be lawful in some way, and they would be, I would think. But exactly what the laws of that realm is would be an exploration in itself of different realms. So we started out with that everything's changing, that there's an unsatisfactoriness to this whole experience, and that there's not much to hold on to even within a given moment, and that there's nature, that we're part of nature, we're not separate from nature. Ajahn Suchito teaches that so beautifully. Some of you may have been at one of his retreats that he's done in the States in the last few years. He teaches that it's just nature so clearly. And then that this nature is lawful, that there's a causality to this. It's not random. There is a lawfulness. Any given moment's experience has a randomness to it, but in a lawful way. It is not, and it's all conditioned. And then as we end up, this is really where a lot of, in my belief is not the word to say, in my experience, a lot of experience of freedom, of maturing internally, is in these three, about the naturalness, the lawfulness, and the conditionality. That we don't go, this is just the way it is. This is the nature of this realm. It's like this. Knee pain is like this. That people do horrible things to each other is the nature of this realm. It's all the nature of this realm. It's all possible. Those of you who've studied the nine bodies with me, that would be because of the seventh body, because it's all that everything's made possible by consciousness arising into the material plane. It's a blessing and with a big cost to it. So this naturalness, that it's lawful, that it's not, there's a causality. It's one because of this, that happens. Because of this, that happens. And then this sense of conditionality. Many of you have had quite a bit of experience coming here, coming to day longs. Some of you have had the privilege of getting to go to a number of retreats. This is the level of which I would really have you reflect and collect what you know and start to own what you know. This idea of nature, of lawfulness, of causality, lawfulness / causality, and of the conditions, that things are due to conditions. That's part of nature, that's part of lawfulness, is this conditionality. That you gather what you know about these three things in an ever deeper way, so that you start to have some ability to remind yourself of this in times of challenge. And the challenge can be, again, of difficulty, or having something that you really like and wanting to hold on to it, not wanting it to go away, when in fact it is going to go away, or it's appropriate for you to let go of it now. You're in a position where you should let go of that because of responsibilities, because of changed conditions within you, or whatever it may be. So these three, I'm saying this over and over again to let it register as best I am able. This naturalness, that nature, this is that there's the nature. We're part of nature. We're not separate from nature. course, that would seem like, again, one of these tautologies. It's obvious that how could we be separate from nature? But do you know how many times we talk about nature being out there? I love nature. I love being out in nature. We're nature. We're being out in nature right here when we're in Sangha together, when we're in community together. It's all nature by the Buddhist perspective. And then there is a lawfulness to this realm. The lawfulness is contained within the realm itself. It's not something from outside hitting this and suddenly you've got cancer. The cancer is coming because of the nature of this realm is for what is conditioned to deteriorate. And so it deteriorates into cancer. I mean, this being grown up about this. The same with the conditionality, the conditions create things to happen. Science certainly knows this. Science treats this way. And then we're moving beyond those three. So first we went to the three characteristics. Then we went to three kind of descriptions of this realm. And now we're going into what's underneath this, but still in this realm, not being in some lofty space yet. Still within this realm, we see that we start to have the experience, and this is a deep experience and can be quite liberating and quite beneficial, is we start to have some understanding of what's being taught as emptiness, this sunyata. That emptiness, that it's empty of what? It's empty of permanence. It's empty of being me and mine. I can't hold on to it. I can't decide for this moment to be other than it is. So it's empty of my ability to control it in that way. It's empty of permanence because it's changed in the next moment. This is kind of startling. And again, it can create fear, but it can also create this, wow. So then if I can't control it, I don't have to be so uptight about it. I don't have to be so anxious about it. I might as well just go along for the ride because the ride's going on anyway. And there can start to be a real liberation as with all of these others also around this emptiness, that it's empty of permanence. It's empty of self. Many further explanations of this. But again, for many of you in all your retreats and all, some of you have come in to me and reported experiences of emptiness on retreat, that you've had the insight, not an intellectual thing, but an insight, an aha, a felt sense of that kind of moment of when you realize, well, this is really true. And it's like, I will sometimes say, you feel it from the top of your head down to your toes. It's like you stepped into it. It's like a lightning bolt hits you. It's not, although that lightning bolt could have been building over many, many times you've thought about this and looked at it, but suddenly you've had a direct experience of it, another word we use. So emptiness, that's an insight into the nature of this realm, but it has a lot of transcending energy in it. Emptiness is liberating energy in it. And then the tathagata, the thusness of this realm, to really realize, yeah, this realm's like this. So there's a thusness, so that the mind doesn't move so much in relation to conditions. There's a kind of stillness, this knowing, it rests back in the knowing and moves less to try to change the condition, fix the condition, and get everything right, so then I'll have this happy life, which, you know, we're all, you know, in the kind of endless pursuit of, in a way that causes us oftentimes to miss the happiness that's right in front of us, because we're trying to get even more in a way that is just not skillful, doesn't work very well. So that's this thusness. So emptiness and thusness, and for me, my experience of the thusness you've heard me ever since Ajahn Sumedho taught me this, it's like this phrase, I had experienced earlier in another tradition this teaching of thusness that was very similar to the way it is taught in Buddhism. And so I found those two, the nature of this realm, and then you get to thusness. It's like a physical experience. It's like just thusness. And so many parts of my life, it is of such comfort to me because I don't go into reactive mind. Where I have challenge, like I didn't have challenge around any of my difficulties I've had over the last 3 years. But I have had real difficulty around when we as a society, we as a nation, we as a globe, when we create all this suffering that's going to be ongoing and our collective stupidity, our collective delusions. That is my hardest challenge, is to see, whether it's the way OxyContin was treated as a product and promoted out, and more people dying from OxyContin than from automobile accidents. That's a number. Having the average lifespan in the U.S. reduced by so many deaths that the actuary tables went in the opposite direction, and so forth. So those kinds of things, whether it's at the political level or the corporate greed level or individual greed level, those things, that is my edge in terms of thusness. But in terms of my personal experience, not so much. That has matured in me significantly, not completely. I don't want to make that claim at all. But as insight, I mean by insight that the insight at the level that I have access to it in the moment where it would be appropriate to have that that access. Does that make sense to you? That it's there. And this is what I'm pointing to tonight with all of these, is that going all the way back to Nietzsche and all, that you have that it shows up when you need it. A friend of yours dies, and you would have a natural grief for that friend. And there would not be anything wrong with your having a grief. That's not your clinging necessarily. That's just, oh, my loss of my friend. Oh, their life was cut short, or maybe it wasn't cut short. Maybe it's the natural. But you would feel the grief. You'd feel the change that had occurred. But each of these insights would arise somewhat spontaneously, or you could remember them. You could deliberately choose to remember them so that you had a larger perspective from which you're meeting these big experiences in your life, or even small experiences. When the other day, someone stepped on my toe 3 different times, and that's just the nature of this realm. I'm like, hello, are you not in there at all? But there was no extra reactivity because it's the way it is, right? Someone out there completely deluded. And one gains a kind of well-being that is starting to be less dependent on conditions. Still following me, right? That we are moving towards having well-being that is less dependent, not totally free of conditions. That's ridiculous. First of all, if you're sick and you can't attend to it, you die. If you can't have food, you starve to death. It's not that level. We still are in the struggle of surviving in life and thriving in life. But our way we're holding it is held in these much larger understandings. That's what I'm pointing to tonight. The last of these 9 insights that have to do with this regular realm of existence, with the conditioned realm, with the so forth, where things are always changing and all, is this word atamayata, that is referring to not resting in any state of mind, not, it's translated often as unconcoctable. That is that because we see the nature of this realm, we don't make up a whole story and then we go live that story. Our momentary mind states don't become an identity. We don't grab hold of them and not let loose of them in that way. And I find this again a valuable insight. I can't. Unconcoctable is just like too hard on my tongue and in my ear. But not resting in any state of mind, not taking that state of mind as something that's permanent, that it's anything other than lawful, that it's been anything other than caused by conditions and all. I really find that helpful. And so to not believe the mind states that we have, so that we have a freedom, because every moment's mind state is just a moment's mind state. I had the pleasure of working with two people independently on a 3-month retreat. One person was at IMS doing their 3-month retreat, and they actually used the 9 bodies teachings as their way to practice insight, and that was a great, and I was allowed to offer practice discussions with them in addition to the regular one they had. And then the other situation was someone went off on their own and just stayed for 3 months by themselves in a little small room where they were all alone for 3 months. And in each instance, I had varying amounts, but more with one than the other, but check-in experiences, getting to suggest reframing experiences for them. And in each instance, as they experienced more the nature of this realm, the more personal liberating insights arose. Each in very different ways, but each really had they're free of personal stuff, a lot stuff that's been there forever, that just in a 3-month period at this level of their experience, because I have a whole teaching about when we're wounded, across time in a way, and we will meet our wounds again and again. That's the bad news. The good news is that we're deeper and deeper over time. Or if we don't go deeper, we don't meet them again. And we're more able to respond to them, and the liberation is so much deeper as we go across time in this way. So, but and each of these people had wonderful experiences, and it was this level that was so rich, seeing oneself, seeing one's nature, so discovering that you have aggression, or discovering that you have a kind of wanting you didn't know, whatever it might be. I'm making up things because I don't want to reveal anything about either of these two people, so I'm not saying anything that's an example from their experience. We're not stuck where we are, although we can often feel stuck, because that's the nature of this realm, right? So as soon as you're feeling stuck, and you're feeling, I am stuck, the emphasis, the beat is on I am, and then, oh, stuckness. Stuckness is part of this realm. How many people do I know that feel stuck? And so suddenly, you've got space around the experience, and there's little new moments that can arise in. But when you are just stuck, you are stuck, because you're believing your mind state. It has become concocted. You are stuckness, and you're not realizing it as something you have a relationship with. It's you. So we're moving from identity to relationship a way. That's the opportunity. There's another series of that Buddhadasa does as these spiritual insights that I'm not going to name tonight, but you've heard in other times, and they're related to the 16 insights, the 10 insights. You know, Buddhists have endless lists, and for good reason. But that isn't the focus. But like here now, maturing of your relationship to your experience with what you already know. With what you already know. If we collect and apply what we already know, we will learn new things. New insights will come. But if we don't collect and unify, if we don't live them in some way, then it's much slower. So, walking our talk, living the Dharma in daily life, which was the founding principle of this Sangha all of those years ago, was to come here on Sunday evening and say how to live the Dharma in daily life, even though we're in fairly, esoteric territory here. We're talking about nature and thusness and emptiness and all that. It's still living the Dharma in daily life. So with that, questions or comments, complaints? We're going to bring the mic around. Maybe the last person could take it to the next person. Well, whatever you want to do it.
So my brain is having a little bit of trouble untangling the concept of lawfulness from what it thinks of as justice and fairness and kind of the rampant unlawfulness that we're seeing at the top of our societal leadership right now. So can you talk to me about
that? One of the things that's confusing for people about the Buddhist practice is that Buddhist practice is founded on sila and dana. So before you would learn any of these insights, you would have developed your capacity, your heart would have been awakened to living an ethical life, which is what sila means, and a generous life. You would be generous towards others. You'd give people the benefit of the doubt. You'd spontaneously help people. It's incorporated into the culture as conditions for understanding insights. Because without that, you can there's levels of insights where from that level of insight, the conditioned realm is not that important one way or the other. So the social contracts of the conditioned realm, if they're not developed as internal characteristics ahead of time, you can end up with unskillful behavior. So the non-harming is a essential part of Buddhism. But the nature of this realm, this realm there is harming that happens in this realm, is not a contradiction to that. It's the non-harming is how you would choose to act in a given moment. That harm happens in this realm is the nature of this realm. And then what we find is that harming is it moves around a lot. Like when an animal hunts another animal, is that harming the animal? Is that really what that is? Is that the way you would? How would they eat otherwise? So it gets to be, but that we don't have to live in the animal realm. That just our animal nature does not have to define us. That's part of the opportunity here. So see the higher standard of sila and dana being in place first. And that can help with that. But if you can handle that the nature of this realm is to have people who are doing horrible things, then you're made less effective in bringing justice. You're not made more effective, you're made less effective. It takes away your power. You know this is the nature of this realm, that in this moment, and so as far as you have choice, that won't happen here. Whether you're on a jury, a grand jury, whether you're voting, whether you're, you know, being a leader in whatever way, whatever situation, you see a child being harmed, you go, not this child in front of me, this moment. That's the way it works. But you are stronger with this understanding. You're not less strong for all sorts of reasons. You're more willing to stand up and risk things of your own because you've got this larger picture. You're not so attached, because people don't stand up because they're fearful for what they're holding on to. Is that?
Yes.
Also, in your, if you had any questions about the meditation, anything that you want to bring in, it doesn't have to be just on this topic. Don't bring up something about some other place, but something that's happened here tonight in this space. Glad to hear that, and I use it like that myself, and I'm suggesting that as a possibility. So you took up the if my mind is really restless, I can come back to here now. If what I come back to is restless mind, but nonetheless I'm there with restless mind, I'm not spinning off in all of my thoughts that restless mind is wanting me to have. So, but I'm still restless mind. That's the suchness, you know. Restless mind. It's part of nature. It's based on conditions, you know, right? But then you're not. I'm not being defined, because if my mind is restless, it's more likely to cause harm if there's no attention paid. So how do you pay attention? Here, now, and then. Did anyone have any experience with this? Demand, let loose of demand.
Yeah.
Up here.
Couldn't be the only one. Hmm. You want to hear about demand?
Pardon me?
Do you want to hear about demand?
Yeah. Was that what you were going to say? Was saying about whatever you want to say.
No, but I was only raising my hand because you asked to kind of
what I was Oh, I see. All right. Well, say what your experience was.
Just noticing at times more gross and at other times quite subtle, a pushing away from experience. The moment, the experience of the moment not being acceptable. And then there could be an opening to accept that unacceptability and just be with that, but yeah, but certainly noticing plenty of moments where there was the, you know, about the mind having moved, or just about the whatever the experience
right.
was.
So that is very similar to my own experience with that. And again, because I've done nothing, I've sort of been laid up for 3 months. I've had lots of time to practice, but couldn't practice well because my mind did not have a steadiness of ways. And so I've gotten to. You're getting the benefit of all of that, so if you'll pass it on.
I find when I have physical discomfort, and that it's as if I try to vacate, and so when I realize that, I can feel myself realigning in here, and I would just drop back in, and it was almost like I was dropping down to earth. Mm. It was a real sense of that, and I had to do that a number of times. But it was when I did that, then I could feel my body relaxing, and it was almost as if the tension I was feeling around here was relaxing as well. So that was it. I realized it's a really good thing to remind myself.
Yeah. Well, so again, this is a little mantra to use, you know, that this, that letting loose of demands, just let loose, or just, it was just saying, I'm not demanding anything. I don't want to demand anything in this moment. That when I did that, and I wasn't planning on putting as much emphasis as I did in the meditation, but I did because when I first introduced it, there was this kind of wave went across the room where a number of minds changed in some way because I could feel the energy change in the room. And I was going, oh, well, good. Then I can go further with this than I'd thought to. You might not use that phrase. You might use something else entirely. But again, because you're here and now, no demand, start over, whatever it is. But it's using mantra, little mantras like that, can be very skillful. And what you're really reminding yourself of is all of this naturalness, lawness, lawfulness, causality. You're reminding yourself of the impersonal nature, because you know the demand comes from this, you know, very young part of ourselves that, you know, I want the attention I need right now, which is a good thing. It's not a bad thing, but it getting to rule the roost is not so good, as we've discovered. One more, and then we'll go back and meditate for a few minutes, the end of time.
I find that after I steady my attention, and then it's the time to open up and see if anything pulls my attention away enough that I should redirect my attention to that, there's nothing that feels, most of the time, there's nothing that feels super compelling that I can't just keep my attention on the breath. So should I just keep my attention on the breath, or should I purposely investigate things that are not really pulling?
I would say I like the question in terms of all the different things it gives me a chance to point out. I would have you just stay with the breath unless there's a compelling reason. But then if you want to practice insight, then you actually start looking at the nature of breath. You say, I'm going to contemplate a Nietzsche in relation to the breath. And sure enough, you see that, you know, I'm going to contemplate dukkha in relation to the breath, or whatever it may be. But so that you can have that one object, and it all unfolds from that. And so that's, in a non-retreat situation, that would be my answer to you. And notice the well-being, if you're there with the breath, so is it noticing the pleasant and unpleasantness of it, and the degree to where that pleasantness is what they call worldly or unworldly. So there you are with the breath. Oh, well, there's ease. There's physical ease. That's well-being. I appreciate well-being. Is that permanent or impermanent? Oh, that's impermanent. Because I know sooner or later that's going to end. But there's some peace here. I'm touching into something that feels like nature, too. That's not so conditioned. And sometimes that's what we can access. This, so that there we are, we're in the body, we're with the breath, and we start with the feeling the pleasant, unpleasant, it's called Vedana, but then we realize, oh, there's something here that's larger, that's impersonal, that I am in harmony. There's some sort of harmony that's larger than my conditioned-based realm in this, and that sense of well-being. And oh, when the mind is not attached to anything, there's a freedom there that is different. It's a different quality freedom, and that it transcends conditions. So that can all come still well with your breath. That's a whole lot of information.